This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I didn't actually see the last half of The Sound of Music until I was an adult.
Yeah?
The whole sad part of it, my parents kind of buffered me from that part.
I think it was a reasonable parenting strategy.
I was pretty sure that that movie ended with them just going up into the hills singing until I was about 18.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Mary Poppins of Education Policy, Victoria Sears.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on again.
We really struggled with pop culture today. We couldn't think of anything, so I had to go with the British reference to the Mary Poppins. We just read Mary Poppins in my house the other day, and so it was on my mind.
It's a great book, great movie.
Yes.
I love everything about it.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. And you worked as a nanny.
I did. Once, right? I'm practically the American / British Mary Poppins.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, your family is from Britain, right? Mm-hmm. And now, when you were the nanny, did you kind of throw in a British accent?
No. When I lived in London for a year for school, I did fool people with my British accent.
Okay.
So I do have that up my sleeve.
See, I think kids listen to people with accents more so than people without
accents. Everybody just sounds great. You sound intelligent and friendly.
Exactly.
I know. And I actually suspected the reason you brought me on today is because one of our topics pertains to a British author. So.
Interesting. Well, we will have to get to that. Absolutely. One of the more famous British authors,
He's
I guess.
Pretty well known.
Pretty well known, yes. Exactly. All right, let's get started. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, who is that British author we're talking about?
Wednesday was William Shakespeare's 450th birthday. Jay Green took the opportunity to lament what he perceives to be a shift away from the arts and humanities in K-12 education, accusing backers of the 21st century skills of being disinterested in the humanities. Is he right?
Well, he's right about the 21st century skills people, sure. I mean, they've been terrible on all these issues, but he also tries to throw Common Core under the bus with this.
I know, Mike, I know. It was an entertaining article, but I still do think that these skills are here. And I would point out to him that Shakespeare is the only author listed in the Common Core standards.
Yes.
That is the only author required, and so he's very much still with us. I think educators are still really evaluating a lot of those things that are in those wonderful seminary, you know, seminal texts that we have kids reading today, you know, vocabulary, cultural exposure, digging into complex texts. So I thought it was an entertaining read, but didn't quite strike true.
I mean, and that, look, this is why, if there's anybody who has been trying to refocus American education on things like the humanities over the last 30 years, who is it? E.D. Hirsch Jr., right?
Right.
With Core Knowledge, the culture literacy guy. And he supports the Common Core because he sees the opportunity, because the standards are very clear. They say schools, you've got to build a content-rich curriculum starting in elementary school, bring back literature, teach about history, teach about science, teach the humanities, right? Now, that message appears to be falling on deaf ears, but they are in there, and it is this opportunity. And that said, I share Jay's concerns that a lot of times our conversations in education, I'm guilty of this sometimes, feels very utilitarian. Mm-hmm. You know, what can we do to improve the economy?
Right.
What can we do to help, get kids decent jobs someday? And we forget that we're not just creating little cogs in the machine. We are creating little human beings.
Right. I think it's a balancing act, and the Common Core really, you know, it stresses these skills that kids are going to need when they go into the real world. You know, they're going to need to be able to read manuals. They should know what the Constitution says. They should have heard wonderful speeches and read them. But at the same time, the Common Core does balance it and keeps really content-rich, wonderful literature in the curriculum.
Yeah. And look, this is one of the reasons why people oftentimes, we have this conversation all the time, they say, how can Fordham be for both standards-based reform, which feels very standardizing, and for school choice, right? And the way is, we say, look, we do believe that there's a core that all kids should know and be able to do. We think the Common Core are a decent start on that in a couple of key subjects. But also believe that we should allow parents to choose schools that fit their own values and their own conception of what is the good and what does it mean to be a good human being and what do we want for our children. Mm-hmm. And what you find when especially as I've become a parent and I have to think through these issues for my own children, is there are some very different ideas out there, and you've got some parents who believe that they you have very, clear, particular vision about what it means to grow up and be a good person. And other parents have different ideas, right? And you have to find a way in our very diverse society like ours to let parents choose schools that fit their values and their vision.
Absolutely. Yeah. Agreed.
So there you go. Take that, Jay. All right. Topic number two.
InBloom, a nonprofit that warehouses and manages student data for public school districts, is shutting down after being beaten up by data privacy hawks. Is this a good thing?
Victoria, I don't know exactly what to think about this, right? I mean, look, on the one hand, I got to hand it to the folks like Leona Hameson and others who have been fighting this fight. I mean, I don't agree with them on a lot of issues, but, you know, I can appreciate a sort of David versus Goliath story here. They did bring down this big behemoth, had a ton of funding from Gates and Carnegie and a lot of powerful people involved. And, you know, they said, look, we don't want our kids' data to be used inappropriately. And they were not convinced that there were safeguards in place. I mean, again, as a parent, I get that. That seems pretty reasonable to me.
Right. And I understand it, too. You know, it's people aren't really familiar with that yet. So it's sort of a new concept in this technology. And I think it causes a lot of anxiety about that. So I understand that side of the picture. But as a researcher, I think it is an opportunity lost if the data would be secure and, you know, kept very safe and used for specific things by schools and districts, that this kind of data collection would have a lot of the potential to improve education for students. If you can really personalize education and have some useful, as a teacher, I would think that having some back information on my students would be incredibly useful. And, you know, I don't have kids yet, but as a parent, I probably would be willing to make that sacrifice to have the, you know, potential benefits from the system.
You know, I do wonder about, we talk about, you know, the Snowden revelations around NSA and the changes that that's making on a national security policy. Look, I think that this debate would not have played out the same way had it not been for that, right? I mean, this really freaked us out that you say, I mean, supposedly those data were supposed to be protected and they weren't. So, you know, we hear these assurances, oh, nothing will happen. Nobody will find out about your kids.
That is a real concern.
It's a real concern. Yeah. And you know, look, people have got to use better judgment. You look at some of these reports or studies or ideas that people have about the kinds of data that we should collect on kids. I mean, we just don't need to feed that fire, right? Absolutely, we need to collect data about student achievement. And we need to find ways to learn about what is working out there and particularly make it available to researchers. But, you know, that doesn't mean we need to ask people if they've, you know, got a gun in the house.
Right. And I don't think people are ready for that. So
we should just assume that in most red states, the answer for everybody is yes. Okay. Topic number three.
The NCAA has determined that it will not regard as valid the coursework completed by aspiring student athletes at 24 virtual charter schools managed by K-12 Incorporated. How do we hold online learning accountable?
All right. So let's explain this a little bit here, Victoria, what's happening, right? So long time ago, there were some scandals with these student athletes where kids would be basically getting terrible grades in high school, passing Mickey Mouse courses, and then going on to play big, you know, college ball and football, basketball. And people rightfully said, hey, come on, this is supposed to be about academics here. This is supposed to be college. So there's got to be some minimum academic qualifications that kids show that they can reach. Okay, so that gets put in place. They save GPAs, a certain number of credits. Well, then there's some games that get to be played with some of these courses. At the time, it was things like correspondence courses, where suddenly kids would be very under credit. And suddenly, a few weeks later, they'd have all their credits in place. We remember this from The Blind Side, the book and the movie where this was an issue, right? Now, the newest version of this is online learning. And the NCAA, among I'm just about the only group out there who has been skeptical of some of these online credit recovery programs, saying, look, if the kid is just sitting down in front of a computer and clicking through and magically earning credits that way, we don't buy it and we're not going to buy it. The question with K-12 is, you know, whether that's what was happening, that these were sort of click and credit programs, or that they were just online learning with a teacher far away, but, you know, real instruction happening. The K-12 people are saying, look, these are good courses. Your standards aren't at all clear, and it's not fair to our students that you now say this credit's not going to be valid.
Right. And I think that is a really important point, Mike, is to have some clarity on what these requirements are. You know, is the problem that the students aren't getting enough time in front of their, you know, direct contact with teachers? So that would obviously be really important. And I think it's an interesting issue because there are obviously a lot of upsides to online education. And it's, you know, another form of school choice for families, for athletes, for example, who need very flexible schedules. That's another positive. If you look at the K-12's website, they have shiny ratings from parents in terms of parent satisfaction. action. But I think for me, the real question about this program specifically is really their student outcomes. Yeah. And that's where you really need to look and see, you know, hey, are their graduation rates as good as, you know, other schools? What are the dropout rates like? Yeah. Things like that.
There's this big interest in moving to competency-based education, which makes a ton of sense to people. Makes sense to me to say, who cares how many minutes the kid's in a seat or mm-hmm. how much time they're interacting with the teacher? The question is, do they know the material? And hey, if kids know it, let them test out of it, right? I'm fine with that. Yeah. Like, kids graduate at age 14 if they know the whole high school curriculum, fine. But that means you need to have tests that you can trust. You need end of course exams. Bunch of states have been developing those, and there's been a backlash to that. Texas went from 10 to 5. Ohio's having a debate about their new end of course exams. And so the other option then is you say, well, then K-12, they have their own assessments, but do you trust them?
Right.
Or do they have an incentive to pass kids along because they get funding that way because that makes their customers happy? Yeah, look, if we're going to keep expanding choice, especially online, we've got to deal with this issue. This is around course choice programs that are getting popular, or these education savings accounts. The sort of idea that we're going to give parents a debit card and they can go out and purchase education. There's a ton of promise there, but I think we have to figure out the solution to how do we have external validation of achievement that people can trust. And if we can get there, then the NCAA needs to come around and say, look, forget the seat time, forget all these other regulations and inputs. Focus on, do the kids know the materials?
Absolutely. I think it's reasonable now, but yep, absolutely.
All right. And by the way, let me just, since we're talking about NCAA, just take the opportunity to say, go blue. All right. I feel better now. Okay. It is now time for everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Dara is the handler. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike and Victoria.
Dara's in for Amber, who is out. Dara, before we get into the Research Minute, I have a question for you. It's a multiple choice question. You ready for this?
Sure.
Mary Poppins or The Sound of Music?
Oh, that's tough. Because I didn't actually see the last half of The Sound of Music until I was an adult.
Yeah.
The whole sad part of it. Mm-hmm. My parents kind of buffered me from that part.
I think it was a reasonable parenting strategy.
I was pretty sure that movie ended with them just going up into the hills singing until I was about 18.
And you know what? I think that, which we said earlier, that's the vision of the good life right there. I think,
explains a lot about Dara to me.
And why she's always singing "The Hills Are Alive." Yes, okay.
That part's not true.
So Mary Poppins, I guess. Is that your answer?
Sure. Although I remember being scared and confused by the animated penguins. They just seemed a little out of place.
Around. That
part was fine.
Yeah. That was big. Of course, that was at the same period as sort of Peter Pan. There's a lot of flying.
So. Yeah,
What's with the English and flying people?
I got nothing, Mike.
All right.
You're representing every British person ever.
Exactly.
On the show.
All right, Dara, what do you got for us for this Research Minute?
I have a new study that looks at a question we ask ourselves a lot. After a controversial change to a state law, what actually happens on the ground? This work is from last month's meeting of the Association for Education, Finance, and Policy from researchers at Bowling Green State. Here's the backstory. In 2012, Ohio, a state we know well, Ohio lawmakers approved a new teacher evaluation system, abbreviated OTES. This study looks at whether district teacher union contracts negotiated after OTES was adopted actually allow the evaluation results to be used in personnel decisions. Or do the contracts protect experienced teachers' jobs regardless of their OTES results? So what happened in these contracts after OTES was mandated? The researchers analyzed the 15 Ohio contracts negotiated on or after September 24th, 2012, and here are the findings. Basically, all of the contracts matched well with the state law in terms of evaluations themselves. They allowed principals to use growth measures, observations, and walkthroughs, but that's where the promising findings end. Results were quite different when it came to reductions in force. most contracts contained provisions that kept seniority as a consideration in determining who stays and who goes. Some even used only seniority and no OTEZ results, which actually seems to be against state law. When it came to transfers, only three districts had contracts that gave administrators discretion to fill vacancies with high-quality teachers. Again, most kept seniority as a provision, and none explicitly required the use of OTEZ scores in transfers. When it came to tenure, again, only three districts had provisions that included OTEZ in their procedures for removing poorly performing teachers. Finally, three districts had contracts that considered teachers' OTEZ scores when deciding how much to pay them. Now, all together, this isn't exactly promising. Basically, they found that for these very important personnel decisions, OTEZ is considered in about 1 in 5 district contracts. But maybe on the plus side, it's important to remember that these 15 districts were the first to renegotiate their contracts after the adoption of OTEZ. So hopefully districts negotiating their contracts now will support rather than undermine the system.
I am just shocked to hear this news, Victoria. Boy, you would never have thought that that the unions would find a way to keep these protections in place. What happens, Derek, if it really is against the law? Then what? I mean, does anybody have standing to sue? Does the state have the right to take money away? I mean, what
will it
here?
Take?
Besides the ones that might actually be against state law because they use seniority only.
Yeah.
The answer is nothing because they're not really against state law. The state law says here is the OTEZ system and you have to use it to evaluate your teachers.
Right.
But beyond that, the state law doesn't say you have to use the evaluation results in making these other personnel decisions. And so the districts, and it's not all the union, I mean, the contract is the negotiation between the district and the union,
right,
are free to wiggle around in how they actually use the scores in these decisions.
The race to the top, I thought, had a requirement that they had to be used for some of these personnel decisions. So I wonder, you know, if these districts took race to the top money, I thought they were supposed to go a little bit further.
And this was actually, OTEZ was part of Ohio's race to the top and their ESA waiver application. But a lot of the what these contracts did was say you have to use comparable evaluation results to the state system. So you don't actually have to use the state system.
Right.
And this is how they're getting away with using evaluations.
Look, I have been writing for a long time now that I've been skeptical of these teacher evaluation systems in most places. I've tried to make the case. Look, it's either all or nothing. If you can have a teacher evaluation system that's rigorous and you can change all these other policies so that at the end of the day, if you find that there are low performing teachers, the 5% of teachers that really need to go, and you can have a way of getting rid of those teachers, okay. But in a state like Ohio, I just don't think that's ever going to happen, right? So why go through all this process of these teacher evaluations, which, by the way, is adding a huge burden on testing, huge burden on administrative time, is pissing off teachers, is hurting morale, and at the end of the day, you still can't get rid of the bad teachers.
Right. I mean, I do agree with you, and this is a discussion that I was having with our Ohio team right before coming in here, is it a bad thing if these contracts undermine an evaluation system that maybe isn't that good? This is a conversation that I was having with our Ohio team right before I came in here is, are these contracts undermining this awesome evaluation system, or are they perhaps taking their own approach to an evaluation system that is untrusted or maybe not that good? Nobody really knows right now, but I think this completely supports what you said of, if you are going to implement something, make it good. And otherwise, you're doing all of this extra work. You're trying to undermine something that's awesome and that gives you extra work too. What's the point?
So, Dara, you mentioned that these were the earlier districts that have been sort of using this system. Do you think that it will get better as time goes on? Or if not, what do you think it will take?
I think it's going to take the districts who are now going through their renegotiations now looking at their neighbors and deciding how much trust they have in the OTEZ system. They're using OTEZ now, and they're going to have to look at themselves and their neighboring districts and say, okay, this is actually helping us make effective personnel decisions. Therefore, we want to codify using it into our contracts. Or they could say, you know what? This system is stupid and it's giving us a lot of extra administrative work, and it's not actually helping us make informed personnel decisions and get the best teachers in front of students. And so we're going to do everything that we can to keep it out of our contract.
And by the way, we're talking about volunteer school boards, right, who have been elected in many cases by the teachers' unions in large part, negotiating with teachers' unions that have professionals going around telling them, here's what you should push for in your contracts.
That's true, too.
I suspect that some of those contracts they studied probably looked quite the same, and that was not a coincidence.
I would imagine so, yes.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Well, that is still fascinating. And this is great that people are doing this kind of follow-up. I mean, this is exactly the kind of questions we need to ask after these big reforms get passed at the State House. What happens at the local level? So I love it. And that was a fantastic conference, I understand.
It was.
AEFP?
AEFP. It is their annual conference. It is awesome. That's basically all I can say. You know, most of the authors that we highlight in the Gadfly, in the Research Minute, you know, we have a very thorough screening process and, you know, try to present the very best research. And all of these authors are presenting their latest stuff at AEFP as well.
Go next year, people. I love it. Okay, that is all the time we've got for the Education Gadfly. Until next week.
I'm Victoria Sears.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.